Hi, I'm Carmen LaBerge. Here's the podcast for Connecting Faith. Enjoy the conversation.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Welcome, welcome, welcome. Good afternoon. I'm Carmen LaBerge. Welcome to Connecting Faith. We are here to reconnect the eternal with the everyday, seek to bring the mind of Christ to bear on the headline news in such a way that you and I would be equipped to enter into the conversations of our day in ways that honor Jesus. And so for those of you who are looking for a literal man on the street report on what is happening in the southeastern United States after this big rain event has passed through, you should hook up with my mom, because I'm getting every 15-minute pictures out the window of their house, which is on a lake in northeast Georgia. And the water has risen in the lake to the point that, let me just tell you that first thing this morning, it was, lapping up over the edge of the dock. And then it moved about halfway up the door on the what's called a boathouse. And then they started seeing things floating past them on the lake. So other people didn't have all the stuff in their boathouses, like, let's say, their life preservers or kayaks or whatever. They didn't have it all tied down, or they didn't have it up high enough on davits. And so she said, it's all just floating by. And of course, my sister and I are communicating back with her saying, you guys could get out there. You could fish some good stuff out of the lake. Now's the opportunity. Seize the day. When we get there, there should be kayaks enough for everyone. So anyway, the latest report from Lakemont, Georgia, is that the water is now at the point where the Georgia Power, which technically owns all the lakes, is talking about doing a controlled release. Now, the problem is they want to release the water from the lake that's actually upstream from them before they release the water from their lake. So I'm telling you, my mom is normally Rand McNally. Today she is the Weather Channel. And so I am getting up to the minute reports about the rising water related to this. This is a huge rainmaker here in the southeastern United States. So just letting you know, that's your little man on the ground report from Lakemont, Georgia. All right. So I want to talk today about Ireland. We invited everybody to be praying at the end of last week about the referendum in Ireland around the subject of abortion. So I'm sure that you've seen the headline news between Friday and today. We've had a few days to sort of process the reality that Ireland voted in what I will describe as overwhelmingly, more than two-thirds of the people who came out to vote voted to strip that nation's constitution of protections for the unborn. So abortion is now allowed for under Irish law for any reason up to 12 weeks of pregnancy. So we have to ask ourselves how this kind of massive moral shift actually happens in a culture. Certainly here in the United States, we have very, very few limitations on abortion access. And even fewer limitations in terms of the timing. And so it makes, it makes the headlines when states want to limit abortion access to, let's say, 20 weeks, or when states want to limit abortion access to the kind of abortion that someone can receive in a non-medical situation. And so when you and I think about Ireland, we tend to think about St. Patrick. We tend to think about Ireland as a Catholic nation. And statistically, we'd be right in much the same way that we would statistically still be right in describing America as a Christian nation, which simply means that the plurality of citizens describe themselves or self-identify with the Christian religion here in the United States of America, even if they are not practicing that faith. And the same would be true in Ireland, even though people would self-identify as Catholic, as opposed to checking some other box, Jewish, Muslim, Protestant, Christian, Hindu, something else. So they're checking the Roman Catholic box in terms of their identification, in terms of religious affiliation, but they're certainly not aligned with the teachings of the Roman Catholic Church on issues like the definition of marriage, sexual practice, and certainly then on this life issue of abortion. So I think that it would now be incorrect to characterize Ireland as a Catholic nation. And so I do think that it's been accurately described by the media as a landslide vote. The Irish people voted to strip the unborn of the right to life, which was guaranteed to them by the Eighth Amendment of that nation's constitution. Those protections were actually voted into the Constitution just 35 years ago in 1983. So we're not talking about ancient history here. We're talking about something that has happened in the course of, certainly of my lifetime. And so we're talking about a moral change that has occurred in a Western European nation that was at one point dominated by Catholic influence. And so it would be no longer influenced by the Catholic faith or by the teachings of the Catholic Church in the same way. So how does that happen? This moral revolution took place in just a 35-year span of time. Well, certainly, to be sure, the Roman Catholic Church has abdicated much of its own moral authority by, what seems to be sort of an endless litany of priests who sexually abused and molested Irish Catholic children and youth. But the massive shift in that nation's theology on the issue of life bears witness that it's not only the church from which the people of Ireland have departed. This is a turn away from the teachings of Scripture. This is a turn away from God himself as the giver of life. And I think that if you want to look to one statement following the action of the Irish people in this vote on Friday, if you want to look at one statement that really tells us just about all we need to know, I would recommend you look at the statement by the Irish Prime Minister. So here are a few sentences from what he had to say following this historic vote. He said, "Today is a historic day for Ireland. A quiet revolution has taken place, and a great act of democracy. 100 years since women got the right to vote. Today we as a people have spoken, and we say we trust women and we respect women and their decisions." Let's just take that opening paragraph of the Prime Minister's speech. First of all, he does acknowledge this is a revolution. This is a moral revolution. This is a theological revolution. This is a social revolution. So let's be clear about what's going on here. This is a very different way of thinking about life and about whether or not we live life under the authority of God and under the instruction of the church as a reliable witness to God. This is a huge moral shift. And then he says this is a great act of democracy. I want you to think about that for a moment. This, in my view, is evidence that the majority of people can be wrong. The majority of people can become convinced of something that is wrong and unrighteous. And so just because the group thinks it doesn't mean that the group think is the right way to go. And so this is not necessarily an act of righteousness, as he rightly describes it. It is an act of democracy. It is an act of the people asserting their will. And there is this conversation of rights. He talks about 100 years since women got the right to vote. He then talks later about, this being, evidence of women's right to have unfettered access to abortions. So the conversation about rights is important to have. What are the inalienable rights that we recognize? Not that we give people. We don't actually give people the right to life, the right to liberty, the right to religion. That we don't give those rights. We don't grant those rights. We recognize them. We recognize that people have an inherent right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Those are guarantees in the U.S. Constitution. And so when we talk about rights, we're having a conversation about things that we do not necessarily have the authority over. Some things are inalienable, which means you can't actually separate them from who we are as human beings. And yet I would say by its action, the Irish people have now separated the right to life as something that they have authority over instead of recognizing that it is under God's sovereign authority. And that's in evidence when the Prime Minister says that they trust women and respect women and in their decisions. That is a statement of autonomy. We've talked about autonomy here on this program, here on Connecting Faith, over and over and over again. Autonomy is the assertion that I am the one in a position to make all the decisions about me. I am self-governing. And so it's an acknowledgement that I have thrown off any authority but my own. And so if you were to go through and read the rest of his speech, you would see in there that he touts some statistics like this one. You know, he's happy that they're no longer going to have to hear stories about the 200,000 Irish women who have traveled to Britain since 1983 to end their pregnancies, which means that 200,000 Irish citizens have been aborted by their mothers in Britain. So other people, you can actually like travel. There's like there's a whole travel industry related to this. That seems a little crazy to me. And then for couples, this was an incredible statement in his speech. He's concerned about these stories of couples who shared of returning home with tiny coffins. Now, let's pause there for a moment. What does that tell you about abortion? What does that tell you about the worldview of those parents? Why would you put anything in a coffin but a person? These are people who know they are committing murder. If they are going to the trouble to bring their child home from a foreign abortion, to be buried on Irish soil in a coffin. Okay, he talks about young women telling their truth. And again, we would have the conversation there about the difference between any individual's version of the truth and the truth, capital T, that we know through Jesus Christ, that we know by God's revelation, that we know because of a restored relationship with the one who indeed is the way and the truth and the life. And then he said this odd thing about stories that have never been heard. And I have to say, now that abortion is just the open door to it in Ireland, you know, now there are stories that will never be told because there are any number of people who will never take their first breath and certainly who will never utter their first word. So he talks about the vote being a vote for the next generation. That is just lunacy on the face of it. And then he talks about everybody deserving a second chance. And this is Ireland's second chance to treat everyone equally with compassion and respect. And I would ask the Prime Minister this. If everyone deserves a second chance, doesn't everyone at least deserve a first chance? And so he went on to talk about the hidden conscience of the Irish people for the last 35 years. And I would say that obviously this is a people whose conscience is not captive to Jesus Christ. This is a people whose conscience is not bound by Scripture. This is a people whose conscience is not seeking to be in submission to the authority of God. And so I encourage you to consider what the Prime Minister of Ireland said in response to this historic vote, changing what the Irish Constitution says in relationship to the protection of the unborn. All right, friends, I got to take a quick break. When we come back, Alan Noble is going to be with me. We are going to talk about his new book, Disruptive Witness, Speaking Truth in a Distracted Age. Are you distracted? Are you distracted by many things? Do you want help in being focused in on what it means to be a follower and witness of Jesus Christ in this generation? This is a conversation you don't want to miss. You're listening to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge, and we'll be right back. Hey, friends, welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge. I'm joined by Alan Noble. He is the assistant professor of English at Oklahoma Baptist University. He's also the co-founder and editor-in-chief of Christ and Pop Culture, which is a website you should definitely check out. He's written for lots of outlets, including The Atlantic, Vox, BuzzFeed, The Gospel Coalition, Christianity Today, and First Things. And he's here with us today to talk about his forthcoming book, Disruptive Witness, Speaking Truth in a Distracted Age. Dr. Noble, welcome to Connecting Faith.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So it's great to have you. You and I have many, many mutual friends. You're a really fun follow on Twitter. Friends, you can follow him on Twitter at The Alan Noble, not to be confused with Alan Noble. This is The Alan Noble. And actually, you are a very entertaining follow.
Thank you. I'm just looking up Alan Noble right now on Twitter to see who they'd be mistaken. Another
right?
A bald man. So I feel like that's good.
All right. Hey, let's start with Christ and pop culture. What are people going to find if they go to Christ and pop culture? And then give us something, you know, like what's going on in the pop culture today where Christians might find themselves challenged and in need of equipping?
Sure. So the goal of Christ and Pop Culture is to help Christians, lay Christians in particular, not just sort of the academics or theologians or pastors, but just all evangelicals, to think critically, carefully, discerningly about the culture that we always already participate in. So our belief is that we're always participating in culture in some sense. And so our obligation is to do it in a way that is glorifying to God and edifying to our neighbor and ourselves. So we do that in a number of ways. Our writers will take cultural artifacts, a movie, a book, a new song, and write about them in a way that models how to be that kind of discerning reader, listener, viewer, et cetera. That's kind of our goal, and one of the things that I would say that for many evangelicals is a challenge today is the amount of content we're overwhelmed with. There's never been so many options for TV shows and movies, podcasts, audiobooks, music. We are just overwhelmed with content, and so.
That's
one of our challenges.
Yeah, and I think that's a good segue into, into a conversation about this level of distraction. A lot of it is electronic. A lot of it is, technology driven. Yeah. We feel like we need to not just have the latest gadget, which also requires us learning new technology, but we feel compelled to be, present on every platform across every time zone. And we have this great fear that we're going to miss out on something or that, we have to give our input on everything. And so maybe everybody doesn't live with the level of compulsion that folks who have some kind of public persona lives with. But I look on Facebook and I think on Instagram, and I actually think this is a problem for people of all varieties across our culture. And so speak to, that level of distraction and how harmful it is.
Yeah. So I think on two levels, I address this in the book. One is our personal level. So what it does to us. One of the chief concerns I have is what it does to our ability to be reflective and contemplative, especially about things like sin. I worry that if we are constantly plugged in, if from the moment we wake up to the moment we go to sleep, we're on our phones, we're watching something, we're listening to something. When are we going to have that time to feel conviction? When are we going to have that time to reflect on our day and wrestle with, did I treat my neighbor rightly today? Right. And so I think for individual Christians, that's something that we need to be concerned about because it does have an effect on our ability to evaluate ourselves. And then the other thing is that, it affects the people that we interact with. So even if we unplugged, right, I think this is very important to understand. So even if we just said, all right, I'm getting rid of it all. It's all just, it's evil. We're going to become Luddites, cut off all technology. Well, our neighbors aren't. And if we have to, if we're bearing witness to those neighbors, if we're loving them, we have to think carefully about what it means to live in a culture that remained connected intimately with this technology, even if we decide to opt out.
All right, friends, we're talking with Alan Noble. The book is Disruptive Witness, Speaking Truth in a Distracted Age. It's not out yet, but you can pre-order it, and Ivy InterVarsity Press has I've got an advanced reader copy, so I actually know that it's coming. It's a beautiful cover. It's actually great. And you obviously settled on just going with Alan Noble in the name.
Yes.
Now, only people who follow you on Twitter would even know that that was a big national conversation about what name you were going to put on the cover.
And that was after the fact, right? So, we'd already decided that it was going to be Alan Noble on the cover, but I did have the conversation on Twitter, yeah.
All right, friends. And on Twitter, you can follow him at The Alan Noble. All right, Alan, so let's talk about the vision that you really cast in the book, because you really cast a vision for a different way forward, particularly for evangelicalism. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so I'm concerned that in order to bear a witness in a modern era that penetrates people's barriers to belief, the barrier of distraction, the barrier of secularism, which makes everyone think that all religion and beliefs are just sort of options like cereal or laundry detergent. In order to penetrate those barriers, we need what I call a disruptive witness, which would make a great title for the book. I wanted to note that. But and so I argue that to do that, there are a number of ways we can approach it. And I think probably the most important way is in our church services. We need to have church services that reflect the solemnity, the seriousness, the reality that we are worshiping a living and transcendent God. Because so often church services reflect more of, let's say, TED Talks or a concert, which can signal to people visiting or even church members that what they're experiencing is not a living faith of a real God, but a kind of option for better living, a kind of self-help seminar. And so I argue our church services should reflect that kind of solemnity, that we should, in our interactions with our neighbors, seek these moments of tension in order to invite them to think about troubling things that make them aware of their need for God. So that's sort of an overview, a very brief overview of the vision.
Okay, so that's awesome. So now jumping to the end, because the basis for all of this is really what you set forth as, you know, the gospel. And I think there's a lot of confusion, but even among evangelicals, there's a lot of confusion about what constitutes the gospel. So I would like for you to tell us, what is the gospel?
So the gospel is that Jesus Christ came to earth as a human and died on the cross for our sins, that we might have life and union with him for eternity.
And I think, Alan, that you in the last chapter, you help us see how that's not just information to be apprehended. It's not even just the restoration of one relationship. You really describe it as something that is far more comprehensive than I think a lot of evangelicals describe it. So I'm going to read this paragraph as a segue to our break. And then when we come back, friends, we're going to continue our conversation with Alan Noble about his book, Disruptive Witness. You say this: the gospel is not a preference. It's not another piece of flair we add to our vest. It's something far more beautiful and disturbing. The gospel is the power to raise the dead, to proclaim the greatness of God in a fallen and confused world. To be a follower of Christ in the early 21st century requires a way of being in the world that resists being sucked into the numbing glare of undifferentiated preferences that we choose to define our identity. Hey, friends, welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge. I am joined by Alan Noble. You can follow him on Twitter at TheAlanNoble. He is assistant professor of English at Oklahoma Baptist University. He's the co-founder and editor-in-chief of Christ and Pop Culture, which you can find online. His writings have appeared in a number of outlets, and we're here to talk today about his book, Disruptive Witness, Speaking Truth in a Distracted Age. Alan, welcome again to Connecting Faith.
Thank you.
So let's talk about evangelism. I know that you, among others, including me, we have a high level of concern about evangelicalism in America today, that there are sort of, you know, the evangelical right and the evangelical left and the evangelicals who just publicly embarrass us all. So let's talk about evangelism sort of in the positive frame in terms of how is the current generation of Christians going to communicate the gospel effectively to emerging generations in America. How is that going to happen?
Well, I think I'm just going to say you should buy my book. Because
exactly. because you're allowed to say that. That's question. All right.
Next question. I don't know what else to say. No. So here's the first thing that comes to mind. A lot of younger people, including myself, are very concerned about issues of justice. And so one easy answer, and it would not be an incorrect answer, would be for the church to do a much better job of caring about issues of justice and being not just for PR purposes and not primarily for evangelism purposes, but because we should do it. And that would attract younger people to the faith.
Or at least stop repelling them. It would at least stop repelling them.
It would. And I think we need to do that. I do want to caution, though, and say that if that's all that we're doing, or if that's primarily what we're doing, then my fear is that what it really means is we're saying, hey, our faith is more attractive. And our faith is more attractive to the lifestyle that you want to live, young people. So come over to us. And so I think what we have to do when the church begins to do a better job on issues of justice, it needs to be driven by biblical principles, and it needs to be driven by the truth and by our obligation to love our neighbor. And it needs to be coupled with a greater sense of the awe and transcendence of God. It needs to be coupled with the reality that we live in a world created by God, and so that people don't come to the church merely because they want a group to be politically active in. That will collapse on itself, just like the religious right is going to collapse on itself and sort of is before our eyes. Mm-hmm. So it needs to be something deeper and richer than that.
Hmm. And you know, more authentic in terms of just our genuine relationships with people in the next generation. I think you really talk about that substantively. And I appreciate how practical the book is in terms of, all right, these are the personal practices. These are the habits I need to sort of recultivate in my own life as a follower of Jesus.
Yeah.
These are the, you know, church or ecclesiastical practices we really need to look at. And we really need to rethink. And then not just rethink, but actually live into and make evident in terms of the beauty and the truth of the gospel. I thought those parts of the book were, you know, in particular my favorite. You are engaged in some efforts and some conversations related to how we can better engage as evangelical Christians on some of the justice conversations in the country. So tell us about the AND campaign. Justin Gibney has been here on the show, but not everybody listens every day. So tell people about the AND campaign.
Yeah, so the AND campaign is a group focused on helping urban Christians to think more critically and engage more effectively in politics from a biblical perspective. And part of the concerns that drove this group, articulated by Justin Gibney and Joe Baraka and Angel Molinato, is that both the right and the left have tended to leave behind urban Christians, black, Hispanic Christians, minority Christians tend to have fairly social, conservative social views on things like marriage and abortion and divorce and things like this, which would make them seemingly be more likely to vote Republican, but they also value things like justice and reforming the criminal justice system and a healthy social safety net and things like this. So in that sense, they're more attracted to the Democratic Party, but neither party really represents them fully. And really, I think that one of the reasons I'm involved in the AND campaign is that I think that describes a lot of us, not only minority evangelicals, but I think a lot of evangelicals. I know I feel stuck in the middle, that neither party fully represents me or even close to represents my values. And so this group is about practical, on the ground, what are things that you can do to get involved in your local community, your local government, to advocate for change on a number of issues, whether it's criminal justice issues or school issues, to promote, you know, human flourishing.
Yeah.
So it's an exciting group.
Yeah. And so, folks, if you're a regular listener here, then, you know, Tony Evans is somebody who you pay attention to. He's also engaged and involved in this. I'm involved. It's called the AND Campaign. You should certainly check it out. All right. Alan, another of our friends, Alan Cross, tweeted me and said, I should ask you about immigration. So I'm going to let you just walk through that wide open door. Dr. Noble, what say ye about immigration?
That's such an open question. What am I? I don't even know what Alan. I'm going to forgive him because his name's Alan. They spelled
it correct. Well, I know, and I think you guys have a similar hairdo.
That's okay.
I think so.
That's a very, very generous way to put that. I would say it's a bald man. So, you know, immigration, I think, is one of these issues that the church should be at the forefront of advocating for better policies. And, you know, right now there are a lot of policies and a lot of issues that Christians have some, I think, reasonable debates about. But a lot of these immigration issues should be slam dunks for us. We should be, I think we should be in agreement, and we need to be vocal and pressuring our representatives. Certainly DACA, getting some actual DACA legislation passed, needs to happen. And if that means Congress passing some veto-proof bill because it doesn't please the president, then that's what needs to happen. But it's not going to happen unless Christians, who have such an influence, as we saw from the last election, for better or worse, but we have such an influence on national politics, we need to make that, we need to make those, our voices heard. So I think for white evangelicals like myself, it can be easy to shrug off these stories of what's going on right now, families being torn apart. And so if you're not following Alan Cross on Twitter, I would recommend doing that. There are a number of other evangelicals and people in the SBC, pastors who are documenting this and helping those of us who maybe don't live in communities where there's a lot of illegal immigrants, but helping us to see what these policies look like and forcing us to ask the question: Is this loving? Is this pro-life? Is this honoring to God? Are there better ways to deal with immigration?
That's helpful.
What I would say. That's my monologue.
Yeah, and we spent a week on the topic last week, so my listeners are fully up to speed on sort of what folks are saying on this. So thank you for weighing in on that. Friends, I want to mention the book again, Disruptive Witness, Speaking Truth in a Distracted Age. Now, in this book, Alan, you don't deal with these issues. I want to remind people that what this book is really about is getting to the place where I can step far enough away from the static of the current moment to know where I'm at with God in my own relationship. And then I might have enough space to be concerned about other people and their relationship with God or lack thereof. And that I might begin putting some practices into place where I can begin tilling that soil in the culture around me. Is that about what the book is? Do I about have it?
Yeah, no, that's accurate. Yep.
Okay, so for friends who have not been following you and I on Twitter this morning, and you guys can follow Alan at the Alan Noble, and you can follow me at Carmen LaBurge. So Alan and I have a mutual friend. That mutual friend's name is Karen Swallow Pryor. We prayed for her here on Connecting Faith about a week ago when she was a pedestrian and was struck by a bus, and she has had at least one fairly major surgery in the subsequent days. She's still got some broken ribs. She has a punctured lung. She is recovering, though. And tonight, she is going to ride home in a medical van from Nashville, Tennessee, back to the campus of Liberty University in Virginia. So we certainly want to pray for travel mercies. Karen is the person who wrote the jacket endorsement on the advanced reader copy that I have of Disruptive Witness, and I want to read it to our listeners. Karen Swallow Pryor says, if you want to know what the next generation of evangelicalism could and should look like, look to Alan Noble. Grounded, faithful, and circumspect, he is asking all the right questions and leading us to better answers. And so, Dr. Noble, I have a question for you from Dr. Pryor. I took her a cup of coffee this morning. I told her you and I would be talking today. And so here is the question from Dr. Pryor. Are you ready?
Yeah.
Okay. If you were hit by a bus, other than the Bible, what's the one book you'd want in your hospital room? Now, let me tell you that she went on to say, as she nodded to the nightstand by her bed, she said, Disruptive Witness. So there you go, man. I feel like I have made your day. I feel like this is now, without question, the best interview you're going to have for this book.
She's amazing.
She's amazing. She's totally
already making hit by a bus jokes.
I know.
It's not even a week. How do you do that? I don't know.
She is amazing. She's totally amazing. All right.
Wait,
did she
really have my book on the nightstand?
Yeah, man. It's the one book she's got in her hospital room except the Bible.
Really?
I don't know. It's crazy. So there you go.
You're really? No, she really did?
Yeah.
I'm not believing you.
Oh,
what?
I was not allowed to take pictures.
Okay.
Part of the deal of visiting in the hospital is that you're not going to take pictures. We're not vain,
sure.
but we're too vain for that. Like that, we just don't.
we do not want
those pictures floating around, man.
No. So if I have to answer the question, I would say Franny and Zooey.
We don't even know what that is.
J.D. Salinger by J.D. Salinger. It's a beautiful book about authenticity and learning to see God in people, God's image in people. Yeah.
Okay. Will you tweet me that so I can retweet it out?
Yes, I will.
Okay. All right. Hey, blessings, my friend. Friends, this is The Alan Noble. The book is Disruptive Witness, Speaking Truth in a Distracted Age. Thank you so much for being with us today on Connecting Faith. All right, friends, we got to take one more quick break. When I come back, we're going to be making the connecting point today with Tim Muehlhoff from Biola University. So don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. I'm Carmen LaBurge. This is Connecting Faith. Hey, friends, welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge. We're talking again today with Tim Muehlhoff to make our connecting point today. We thought we'd grab a couple of things from the headline news and we would talk through them from a Christian or biblical worldview. Tim is on the faculty of Biola. His list of books is really long. Some of my favorites on the list, Authentic Communication. I would highly recommend that one. I also love The God Conversation, Using Illustrations and Stories to Explain Your Faith. He did a 10th anniversary edition of that book, I think just last year. And then topping my list is Winsome Persuasion, Christian Influence in a Post-Christian World. So there's some reading you can do with Tim. Tim, welcome back to Connecting Faith.
Thanks, Carmen. Glad to be here.
All right, so let's just jump off at the deep end here, and let's talk about Starbucks. What happened yesterday, and why is it important?
Well, yesterday, Starbucks took an unprecedented decision to close all their stores in the United States, that's over 175,000 employees, for 4 hours of racial diversity training. It's been estimated that it costs Starbucks anywhere between $12 to $14 million in order to go through this racial sensitivity training. It's based on the fact that two African-American individuals in a store were arrested in Philadelphia, and Starbucks chairman David Howard Schultz was just appalled and said that we need to do training. But here's what's interesting about this, Carmen. So I look at that, and I want to do what Aristotle suggests. He suggests that we start affording each other goodwill, that we start believing the best about each other if we're going to get out of this crazy argument culture we're in today. But I have yet to find one Christian, and this was yesterday because I knew I was going to do this today, I have yet to find one Christian who spoke positively about what Starbucks did. Here's virtually what everybody said. Well, you know why they're doing it. They got negative press, and they're losing money, and this is why they're doing it. I don't believe a second of it. I think this is them just caring about the bottom line. And so this is ultimately great PR. And, yeah, they might lose $12 million, but they're going to recoup that in a heartbeat. And Carmen, I was shocked. I got to be honest with you. I was like, but wait a minute. Could we not believe the best about Starbucks? Could we not believe that something happened in a store that was so egregious to the chairman and the CEO that they decided, and again, 12 to 14 million. I don't know if you have that laying around, but that's a pretty big statement to me. But I found it interesting that as Christians, I think this is a good indicator that we're part of the argument culture today, and a key part of the argument culture is I don't afford goodwill to anybody. I don't believe the best anymore about anyone. We've become cynics.
Well, I think we have become cynics. I think that this particular conversation, actually Starbucks, I feel like, gives us constant opportunity to engage the culture. Like, I feel like, you know, they came out with a totally red cup, and people, I don't know, some people. It seemed like a totally made up outrage. People are upset it didn't, right. It wasn't a Christmas cup. I'm like, well, friends, that's because it's a crucifixion cup. It's totally red. How are you missing this as an opportunity? I mean, it even was like gradations of red. It even got a little bit darker red if you paid attention. Like, you know, how does this not, as a Christian, give you the opportunity to connect Christmas with Easter? Like, so, you know, and the cup was even, you know, red on the outside and white on the inside. I'm like, what, you know, why are we so quick to be, as you point out, you know, picking out the pepper instead of being the salt? And so I think that
that's
for my sister.
Point,
you can steal that. You can have that. That's my sister.
And you know what's funny is this comes right back at us. So take Chick-fil-A, for instance, where the CEO of Chick-fil-A got hammered because he said, you know, I'm guilty as charged. I believe in traditional marriage. And they all got hit with the Taste Like Hate campaign. But remember when the Pulse nightclub, 40 individuals were shot in a gay nightclub? Unprecedented. Chick-fil-A opened on a Sunday to give free chicken sandwiches to anyone that was donating blood, EMS workers. Well, if we have this attitude towards Starbucks, you better believe that gets turned around in a heartbeat and sent right back at us, where people would say, well, of course Chick-fil-A is going to do this. They were getting hammered as being homophobic and anti-gay, so here's a great opportunity for them to get some good publicity and pass out some chicken sandwiches because this was a gay nightclub, so they're actually riding on the backs of slain gay attenders. I mean, where is this going to end if the church doesn't step up and the church says, you know what, we are going to believe the best about people. We are going to believe that you care about this country, you care about this community, that we're in this together. And yeah, that might be a little naive at certain points, but unless we change the current dialogue where we don't believe the best about you, you don't believe the best about us, we're never going to get any traction in changing the national discourse.
So I visited a Starbucks this morning, and it's not my regular Starbucks, so it's a bunch of, you know, baristas that I don't know. And so I walked up to the counter, I ordered what I needed, and while I'm standing there waiting, I have a conversation over the machine, you know, to the person who's working back there. And I said, okay, so you guys did this thing yesterday where you all did this diversity, you know, awareness, you know, what was it like? What did you learn? And this person had this big smile on their face, and they said, you know, we're all university students, right? they all go to Vanderbilt. This happened to be where it was. And I said, yeah. And they're like, this was not new for us. So I do think that there's some there's like a generational conversation. There's like a context conversation. I think that I'm going to encourage Christians, when you go to Starbucks, have the conversation with the people. Like, what did you learn? How did it influence or affect the way that you're thinking or reacting or responding? Is there a way that I could help? You know, did you leave with a question that maybe we could talk about? I think that, you know, Christians, if we were willing to actually engage, we might be better off.
See, Carmen, that's brilliant. I think that's, man, let's use these moments. They're very seldom do we get handed these cultural moments. So I would encourage all your listeners, go into Starbucks today and have exactly that kind of conversation. Because when we do that, this is exactly what Howard Schultz, the chairman of Starbucks, said that he wanted Starbucks to be. He wants it to be, he called, a third place where Americans can sit down and have these kind of conversations. So I would encourage listeners for the next week or two, just go in and have an honest conversation and say, hey, I was encouraged that you guys did this. What did you do? And I thank you for making such a bold statement to the country that race is something that's worth $12 to $14 million for us to have a national conversation. Kudos to Starbucks.
Yeah. Hey, friends, you're listening to the voice of Tim Muehlhoff of Biola. We're going to talk about one more subject. Tim, you think that we've got time to talk about Roseanne Barr?
I do.
All right, let's just jump in. This is some deep water. I think that there's no question that what she chose to tweet, and we will not be saying here on the air what it was, but what she chose to tweet about another human being was certainly beyond the pale. It was, however, not really inconsistent with who she is or the way that she has presented herself over the course of time. So I'm curious, you know, as a person who, you know, pays attention to what's happening in Hollywood, ABC's reaction or response of firing her and canceling the show, just kind of walk us through what you think's going on there.
So Carmen, the argument culture teaches us to find out what's wrong first and then maybe move to what's right if we ever get there. So let me just say, I wouldn't be supportive of ABC bringing back Roseanne Barr. I just do think she's too inflammatory. I do think she has a history of racist tweets. She has a history of very volatile, you know, communication, and she doesn't back away from it. So I was disappointed that they brought her back. But let's give them kudos, ABC, for firing her. This show is wildly successful and already was upped for a second season, and they were literally putting their fall schedule around this show. So it is no small thing that these people who want to make money got up and said, okay, this is enough. We just in good conscience cannot do this. So I want to say to them, hey, kudos. I think as Christians, we can be greatly encouraged that God's common grace, right? This is how we know about justice and fairness and beauty, is working in all people. So I really want to applaud the people, the executives at ABC for stepping up and saying, okay, this was a line too far. And I'm encouraged that culturally we still have lines that go too far. I want to celebrate the fact that when you trip that wire, non-Christians stand up and say, that's enough. We just can't do that.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, Tim Muehlhoff, thank you.
Can I make one other controversial point before I leave?
Sure.
Okay, so this is, I think as Christians, evangelicals, we're in a really rough spot. One, I do think the Trump administration has done some good things. I think when it comes to Supreme Court decisions, it was really good to place a conservative, hopefully, on the bench. I do think the stuff he's doing for veterans is really notable, and I do think he's done some business things that are really good. That being said, I just find it inconceivable that our president gets up and tweets this morning about Roseanne Barr and does not condemn what she says. He rather says, well, I'm ticked off at ABC because they've treated me poorly, and why didn't I get an apology from somebody? So again, I want to say you're the president of the United States. So ABC's condemning what she said. Her agent condemned what she said and dropped her. Cast members are condemning what she says. I want to hear from the president of the United States to say, look, I generally like this woman.
Right,
but
we're gonna
what
have
she
to
said
leave
was
it.
Beyond the pale.
We're going to have to leave it right there. All right, friends, you know I'm not looking for my moral authority in the White House. So we will continue this conversation on Connecting Faith tomorrow. You can communicate with me on Twitter, at Carmen LaBurge. You can also communicate with me via email, carmen@myfaithradio.com.
Thanks for listening to this conversation from Connecting Faith. These podcasts are available because of listener support. You can make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend to grow the impact of Connecting Faith. Also, take a moment to subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player and never miss a conversation.